Hello, everybody. This is Fred Hayes, Apollo 13 from the States, wishing I could be closer, even in person, for the celebration 50th anniversary since we flew that mission back in 1970. Kind of auspicious with the current circumstances we have around the world. Our mission in the week before our flight had a great challenge and threat of a virus. We had all been exposed by Charlie Duke, who had gone to a birthday party with his son, to German measles, which is a virus, although I'll have to say not near as threatening as the one the world is dealing with today. Nevertheless, though, it caused us within the crew a traumatic incident. We were all exposed, and through the blood work and testing, it was determined that Ken Mattingly, the primary crew command module, which Jim Lovell and I had worked with through a previous whole crew assignment, Apollo 11. We were the backup on Apollo 11. And here we were already going 13, and Ken was replaced. The decision was made 2.5 days before our launch that Jack Schweigert would replace Ken. So that was a very traumatic decision, and kind of took away for me a little bit of the excitement of going with that, just seeing how distraught that was. I knew for Ken to have worked that hard to get to this point and then be pulled off at the last minute. Should have known then that Apollo 13 wasn't going to be exactly the normal mission.
So Ken ended up flying on Apollo 16 and had quite a good space career. He ended up doing a deep spacewalk, which wasn't planned on 13. So I guess out of everybody, he was the big winner. Would you agree?
I would agree. I think Ken is not. He really still feels like he wished he'd have been on the mission. He of course served well on the ground where he worked in the special teams that Gene Kranz had set up, particularly with a development of a procedure to turn on the command module. Since the mothership, the command module was never intended to be turned off ever in flight. There was no procedure on how to turn it on. Normally, it was turned on the launch pad with a lot of people involved in support equipment. And so this was the first time ever it was going to have to be turned on the fly. And literally, it had to be a great procedure because they didn't turn Jack Schweigert and I on to activate that vehicle until 2.5 hours before entry. So we were sitting there in this cold, dark spacecraft, knowing we're going to enter in 2.5 hours, and now had to power this thing up and hope it would work well.
Right. So I'm just curious, as I mentioned before, we do have a number of the Australian tracking station staff on our session today. Did you have any awareness at the time of the global tracking network and the various stations, and do you recall at all during the flight, I suppose you were so busy, any interactions or awareness of Honeysuckle Creek, of Parks, of Tibbinbilla and those sites?
No, I'd have to say I did not. The only thing I knew is something other than normal had been done was as part of the power saving on board to make this two-day landing craft last 4 days was we did not turn on our power amplifier. Normally that might have gotten low bit rate, I guess, from the lunar distance, but probably would have not got high bit rate, and certainly not TV when they had the bandwidth for TV. But I suspected that something different was being done on the ground to make sure they got high bit rate data.
So you may or may not be aware of this, and I probably won't explain it very well, but one of the challenges that I experienced was the transmitter on the Saturn third stage, which was kind of traveling in parallel with you, was frequency transmitting on the same as the lunar module,
right,
which in the normal circumstances wouldn't be a problem, but in your mission, it was, so they had to spend time trying to separate the signals out, which was quite a lot of work done in Australia and other parts of the world to make that happen. So I'm not
Yeah,
sure that he...
I, of course, was not aware of that. I knew we were having some communication problems, but I was not aware of the exactly why. I assumed it was kind of like vehicle attitude because it was changing in that time, and maybe that was it. We'd lost signal strength.
Right. And Fred, your recollections of going around the moon and seeing the moon, obviously a unique experience.
It was entirely the views out the window, even from low Earth orbit. We went in orbit barely over 100 miles and only went around a couple of times. But the views there, and of course going out toward the moon and back and at the moon itself, at times, to me, almost seemed unreal. Am I really sitting here looking at what I'm looking at? It was one of the two things that was quite different from all my years of aircraft flying, both in military and as a test pilot for NASA for 7 years. That's those views. The second thing, most unusual in space flight, was the zero gravity, of course, be able to float around. Other than that, though, the rocket ride, vibration levels, G levels there, or entry, were less than I experienced in airplanes. So that wasn't that big a deal. But the view around the moon was most spectacular to me because of the difference I saw in the backside. You know, obviously we all our lives have looked at the front side of the moon. That's the only side we look at. But how much more rugged and beat up it looked. Of course, we only saw a little over half the backside. We couldn't see the whole backside. But it only had a few of these, what I call Mars dark areas, like the huge ones on the front side. Some people can even see a face on the moon. But we did capture some good pictures of two very prominent ones, Tsiolkovsky, which has a nice mountainous-looking feature right in its center. Tsiolkovsky was, I guess, a rocket scientist. It was an early rocketeer, like Dr. Goddard was in the United States. And the other one was the Sea of Moscow. But other than that, it was just crater after crater after crater. And I'm sure if you had better definition, you'd have seen craters within those craters. But the whole backside was just very rugged. Which tells you that somehow, I don't know if it's Earth's attraction that sucked them in, but the bigger meteorites obviously had hit more on the side facing us to create those big Mars or seas.
Right, right. Something that you experienced which you never hear spoken about very often is the Earth re-entry. What was your recollections of that? I guess one of the things you were worried about was whether your spacecraft was going to be intact and hold together. But putting that aside, the rest of the reentry, how did that feel?
Well, first of all, I think you're implying the heat shield. I never thought of the heat shield. In fact, that it would be damaged. To me, it's pretty tough material. And the damage we saw on the service module when we separated looked pretty much like that panel blew out sideways, went straight out and tore up a lot of stuff as it went out, you know, thermal blankets, some of the electrical wiring in there, and did not look like it would have impacted downward toward the capsule. So I felt that we probably, even if it might have briefly crossed my mind, that I never thought the heat shield would be a problem. What was probably the only two unusual things? First one, we obviously were still freezing. It was still pretty cold in there. It had not warmed up significantly. And we got rained on a little bit because water had built up over everything. In those days, in that very cold environment, the water separator was well below its specifications, and it could not remove moisture like we're breathing out moisture. And it was evident in the limb as well, even before we left it. And that water fell out from behind the panel. So we had a little light rain shower right at the top of entry as the G's started building up. The other thing that was really incredible was the condition after being frozen for 4 days. The water tanks were found frozen, and when they recovered it on board the ship in the command module. So it had gone below freezing, well below specifications for all, certainly all the avionics, electronics. And that vehicle had come to life, and it was flown. Jack was ready to take over should it not perform well, but it did. It, through the computer, automated, it flew that trajectory. And if you look at the post-flight data for the whole Apollo program, we tied for the second most accurate splashdown of the program.
Wow.
Which is, you know, incredible for that ship to have been abused for 4 days and then come to life and do that job. Yeah.
So do you ever go back and visit your spacecraft, the Odyssey?
Is it? Oh, yes. In fact, I would have been there today's, what, April 10th. 6 days ago, I would have been at the Cosmosphere in Kansas. We had planned an Apollo 13 celebration there on that day, April 4th. And, of course, this virus changed a lot of things, including that. And so I did not get to go back. But we've normally held those celebrations, not every year, but quite a few of the years, because that's where our capsule is.
Right. And so in recent years, you've been involved in the Infinity Science Center in Mississippi, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. It's the first building you see as you come along Interstate 10, a major thoroughfare, from Louisiana into Mississippi. It's on the right, the first thing you'll see entering Mississippi. And you get there by getting off at that first exit. And to the north at that exit is Stennis Space Center.
Oh, I see. And,
so we're somewhat in partnership with NASA. They use our Infinity as their visitor center. Because of all the security rules, people can't just run around like they used to out at the center. So our facility furnishes the public view of Infinity. In fact, one of our galas, the Space Gallery, tries to do that job as well as cover NASA overall. One gallery upstairs is the Space Gallery.
Now, I haven't been there myself. I'd love to get there, but I believe at the front of that museum, you've got a unique connection to a piece of hardware out there. Is that right?
I'm sorry, at the front is connection with what?
A piece of hardware on display there, the Saturn V first stage.
We have on the west side of the, I think you're talking about the west side of the building, we have a Saturn V first stage, full with engines. It was the last one that had been built at the Michoud facility, you know, 50 years ago, roughly. And it had actually been shipped to Stennis with all five engines on a barge up the Pearl River and then into Stennis and the waterways they built. Man-made canals to be tested. They fired all five engines on that stage to have it ready to go to Kennedy Space Center. And it got caught with the cancellations of Apollo 18 and 19. So theoretically, I like it there because it's, if I had got to fly 19, I backed up John Young on Apollo 16, which put me in a rotation to fly 19. That's the first stage that would have lifted me off the pad again, get on my way to the moon. We also have a full-scale lunar module sitting next to it now. It came from Kennedy. It was our training mock-up that we got in to start all our EBA training down at Kennedy on that practice lunar field. We'd always start in that mock-up to go through all the procedures, getting ready to go out, and then go out on that lunar field and do our, you know, 4 hour plus EVA exercise.
Right. And you backed up John Young on 16. And
yeah.
as part of that training, did you fly the lunar landing training vehicle?
Yes, I flew it 22 times.
Wow. How was that? That apparently that's supposed to be quite a piece of...
As Neil has said, you know, at the time Neil ejected, and then after the mission, they were really thinking they would get rid of it, NASA management, because they crashed two of them, actually, three of them, ended up three of them were lost. Joe Algrani jumped out of another one. Had a closer shave than Neil. He only got about one swing of the chute before he hit the ground. And Stu Present jumped out, sitting straight and level at 500 feet when he lost electric power.
Wow.
A NASA pilot. So they were ready to give up on that machine. But Neil told them, he said, if you want people to land on the moon, the task and the stress level provided by this trainer is what you ought to have the person have that background experience to do the job right. So Neil's the one who kind of talked NASA management out of that thought. And so all commanders got quite a few flights in the machine. Right. No, it was somewhat dicey in that the way you set up and the task you had put you into a time-limited situation for fuel, just like you would be in the moon. Of course, the exception was you had a bailout. You had a plan B. You could switch out of the simulation mode and then depend and fly on...
you got a crew member with you there.
And fly on your jet engine and just use the little attitude thrusters and pretty easily land just using the jet engine. So it wasn't as bad as landing on the moon in that sense, at least.
For sure, for sure. And after Apollo, you stayed with NASA and helped in the development of the space shuttle, the approach and landing tests.
Yes, actually, the way I helped first was I transferred from the astronaut office, and I went to work for Aaron Cohen in the Orbiter Project office. So I really, for 4 years, I went into program management on shuttle. And I served on the evaluation team that evaluated the four proposals that came in to pick who would build it. Rockwell, as it turned out. And so I was Aaron's technical assistant, if you will, throughout that time. Served on the change board, evaluating all engineering changes. I led the ops team, which is a mix of astronauts, mission controllers, our training people, to review the designs as we went through the series of designs. Typically, you go through for the development of a vehicle from program review to system review to preliminary design review to the critical design review that would kind of commit you to build it at that point, cut metal. And so I led the ops team through all the design reviews through CDR on Enterprise. And I led the team on preliminary design review on Columbia. Before then, I got reassigned to the astronaut office and named as the commander of Crew One to go now fly Enterprise. So it's very much a womb to tomb experience. I was there from day one of the paper proposals coming in to now get to fly that vehicle for the first time. So I look at it actually as the crowning achievement of my total career.
Oh, wow. So during that time, Fred, in the development, design, etc., of the space shuttle, as we now know later on, it failed to meet all of the sort of cost and schedule targets and plans that it had to make it a very economical and rapid turnaround vehicle.
Right.
Were you aware of that at the time, or was
Pretty early. See, the fallacy of the what sold shuttle and to be in that vogue, if you will, was assuming you could achieve a certain flight rate. And at the time, early on, it was thought that we could make 24 flights a year, launch 24 times a year. Now, if you spread 24 flights a year over the same, call it overhead burden of labor, of material, and whatever, you know, the cost obviously is lower. And, of course, I think the most in any one year ever flown was 8, I think, 1 year. And so that was the fallacy. We also have to realize, again, even though we're now in the 70s and 80s, technology still wasn't quite far along to do what we might do today more with that kind of vehicle is automation, even on the ground processing. So we were very, very labor intensive And if you look at recurring costs, a big part of recurring cost is the payroll. How many people you have employed to make that happen. We also, because of weight drivers, we had Air Force people involved early on trying to coach us on maintenance and what provisions to make for maintenance that would make it faster, easier, more efficient. And some of those added weight, some of the ways they would have done it that they would normally do on an airplane. And so we threw out some of that might have helped also the situation. So, no, I would like to make a B model someday. I don't think that'll happen very soon. But with the learning, learning we have on that first one, we could probably do a much better job in that regard with today's capability, particularly computing power. You have to realize Enterprise I flew, its computer was like 1 megabyte.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it was an IBM 101. We inherited that had been on the B-1 program and the manned already laboratory program, the Air Force program that got canceled. Most people don't realize where we were in computers then. Now, you can't even buy anything less than about a 16 gigabyte thumb drive, and it wasn't too long ago, you could only buy even an 8 or something. It was big. So computing assets have grown tremendously. We flew to the moon, in 1/10 of a megabyte. Wow. Hand-wired. There were no chips yet then. So that was a hand-wired machine we went to the moon with.
Going back to Apollo 13, did you, I assume, follow the investigation fairly closely about what exactly happened? How did that make you feel, and were you angry that decisions and things had been made the way they were, or was it something else?
No, I wasn't angry. It was errors made. Like the instrumentation they provided to poor tech when they used the heaters to get rid of the oxygen in the tank. They topped out at a reading at a point well below the red line. So the poor tech was sitting there observing, and of course it exceeded the red line, but the meter didn't track where it had gone to in the tank. So, you can't say that was human error. It was whoever arranged the setup for this exercise they did of detanking one oxygen tank. But this is several weeks before launch, actually, in the wet countdown we did. No, you could say configuration control was a problem, and that beach in their upgrading of the tanks on that particular tank had not upgraded the thermostats to be compatible with higher voltage that was used at the Cape, which was, I think, 60-some-odd volts, whereas it had been, pretty much for spacecraft power, which is about 28 normally, but could, I think, 32.5 was our normal high on the DC bus. So they missed that. But you have to think again of this world of computing assets and capability. Today, all that kind of configuration control is computerized. Then everything was paper system. Everything had to be written, signed off, sometimes even double stamped, sometimes by a person, by a quality person for the company, by a quality person for NASA, all paper. And so you think of having a paper that tracked the number of pieces and parts in that Saturn V rocket and 2 spacecraft, and if that's the only error ever made was on our thermostats, that wasn't too bad, I guess, considering the way it was done.
For sure. It was amazing. And yeah. And here we are 50 years later, and we're still struggling to get the Artemis program up and running. And have you been following that much? Have you got thoughts on that at all?
Only what I can read in the media. I'm not involved with NASA or any of the companies directly. So the worrisome thing is, as it has been really since Apollo, is will it be funded adequately? so it can keep moving and you don't end up with stalls and stops, and eventually, like Constellation, be canceled. That's the threat. Yeah. It's the old story. Apollo was unique in that we had a mission defined, and it had pretty much the full backing politically, a president through Congress, and was funded properly. At least through Apollo 11. There was some back off of the funding following that, but at least up to meeting the goal, it was fully funded per program plan. And Shuttle had that problem initially. In the program office I was in for Orbiter, we were somewhat underfunded from the program plan for the first 3 years. And that's what made us end up with deletions. We had a second Enterprise, the one I flew. We had a backup vehicle. Normally, if you run a test program, you want more than one vehicle in case something does go wrong. Air Force normally will fly an initial test program with 6 or 7 prototypes. So anyway, we canceled the second Enterprise. We turned our structural test article, OB-99, into a flight vehicle. That became Challenger. That hull was never supposed to be a flight vehicle.
Oh, right.
So we saved building another hull. Thermocouples on Columbia, the early flights did a lot of, quote, thermal testing on orbit, not in a chamber like we did in Apollo.
Wow.
Vibroacoustic, we kept the F-section vibroacoustic article. Vibroacoustic is where that's the sound waves and the pressure from the engine thrust that, you know, at launch. But we canceled the crew cabin. That worried me at the time we did that. A lot of arguing about it, I'll tell you. Because the facility we did those tests in to test that F section, we had to add horns in there to create the dB level because it was higher than Apollo. Because the orbiter sits a lot closer to those engines. You know, our capsule and the service module are way up on the tippy top on the Saturn. So we were facing a higher dB level acoustic stress than we had in Apollo. And so we deleted one of our 2 major test articles for that.
Wow.
So those kind of things were done to take money out and still try to hold schedule, which is always your driving thing, because you're always worried about what's going to happen when you change administration, too. Where one president started the program, and here you're going to go through the cycle maybe with a new leader, and how he will feel about it and how he might continue to support it.
For sure, for sure. So, Fred, you chose not to stay with NASA and fly in the shuttle. I assume that was an option for you. Just decided you'd had enough and wanted to do something different, or what?
Well, the main thing was the mission changed. I was assigned with Jack Lausma to fly the third orbital mission, and it was an exciting mission. We were going to go rendezvous and save Skylab and keep it from dropping in Australia, I guess, parts of it. or boost it higher, depending on what the policy decision makers would have decided. But we're going to fly up in rendezvous and hit a little kick stage that was well along in development. It was past CDR, and they were putting parts together by Lockheed Martin in Colorado. Fly it in a payload bay, and Jack actually was going to remotely fly it over to dock it with Skylab, and then the people on the ground would actually orient Skylab the right direction to either posit grade or retrograde to boost it or deorbit it. And that mission went away, and then all was left was some RMS arm checks and part of that thermal testing I mentioned on orbit, to sit in various attitudes for certain lengths of time collecting thermocouple data. And the mission just wasn't that interesting to me as it had been. And I had the opportunity at that time to join Grumman. In long range, I was thinking of more going into the executive program management side. So that the opportunity came by, and I took it, and I had 17 good years with Grumman. One of the contracts I had, interestingly, one of the large ones was with a team with Lockheed and Thiokol. I turned around shuttles on the ground for 12 years at Kennedy. I had what's called shuttle processing contract for 12 years. And then I actually left the division, a subsidiary company I had doing service business for Grumman, to go to Washington and led a contract we'd won to do the system engineering and integration on Space Station Freedom. So I did that for 4 years in Washington for the early Space Station Freedom, the one that didn't ultimately get built. ISS ended up being a slightly different configuration. But those were an interesting time. You talk about short money. That program was underfunded from day one.
Is that right? Wow.
Oh yeah, it was a horrible challenge to try to hold that thing together. Fortunately, the Russians joined the program. That's what solidified it politically. That had Congress properly funded to eventually get ISS on the road.
All right, we're going to wrap up here soon, Fred. I'm going to go back to Apollo. You and I met each other in person for the first time, which was wonderful, back in 2018 at Space Fest. And I'm not sure whether you caught the fact there, but there was one of the exhibitors there had an Apollo computer that right. they were restoring and getting up and running. Right. Did you have a look at that? I believe you were a bit of a computer expert back in the Apollo era. Is that right?
Yeah, I looked at it. I mean, it was a complete machine, and he had a disky, which was a little keyboard that we used with this kind of weird syntax. You had a verb noun kind of syntax. But it appeared to be working. Now, there's no way of checking without hooking it up with some simulation of sorts to, say, run the entry program and see if you really had all the ones and zeros in the right place in there. But it was, as far as it was a true machine, a flight machine in every respect.
Fantastic. All right, Fred, well, thank you so much for today. Do you want to say a last few words and we'll wrap it up?
Well, I just say again, I wish we wasn't under this cloud, if you will, of this thing, and that we were all free to go back to our normal lives, because I think that the term used in the States for this staying at home is hunkering down, and I'm getting kind of tired of hunkering down myself. I assume a lot of other people are, but it's unfortunately, I guess, the only way we're going to put this thing to bed and get to the other side. So I do. I wear. Feel kind of funny, but I wear a mask and wear rubber gloves. I do have a mask that was a footprint made for me. It's actually got a space symbology. You got six of them, so it's got actually a rocket that kind of looks like the Saturn V, right about where my nose is.
Fantastic.
So anyway, I can wear that when I go out.
Wonderful.
So well, anyway, have a happy time, everybody, and I hope this internet works out on the web to have this gathering.
Thank you so much, Fred. And once again, thank you so much for taking time. Do look after yourself and your wife, and enjoy your 50th anniversary, however you're going to be able to do it.
Likewise, everybody else, take care of yourselves.
Thank you so much, Fred. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'll talk to you sometime soon.
Okay.